Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Carver Watson with Let's Talk.
We acknowledge the sovereignty of all First Nations people right across the country, particularly the local traditional owners, the Yuggera, Turrbal, Yugurupul, Yugambeh, Kabi Kabi and Quandamooka people. And we also acknowledge our old people, elders of the first people of the country and elders of all more recent arrivals. Good morning to you all. And of course, our listeners tuned in right across the country via the National Indigenous Radio Service. It's great to have your company. I'm joined by a special guest this morning, Acting Premier of Queensland, Jackie Trad. Good morning.
Good morning, Carver. And can I join with you in acknowledging that we sit and operate on Aboriginal land, and can I add my respects to Elders past, present and emerging?
Of course you can. And I'm sure lots of people will be appreciative of your understanding and your acknowledgement. But to start off with, we always ask our guests where they hail from and a bit about their background. So if you wouldn't mind, could you, for our listeners, share a bit about, where you grew up and where you're from?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I grew up in this community in the inner south, grew up in East Brisbane and have lived in West End all my life. My parents actually migrated out from Lebanon, so I consider myself a Lebanese Australian, and growing up in Queensland during the 1970s and early 80s, it was a really interesting experience coming from a different culture, being the second generation migrant, because you always had, weird wog food in your lunchbox. And, it was a really interesting time to grow up. I remember during that time that there was the abolition of the White Australia policy, for example, and there was a big new thing called multiculturalism that Bob Hawke and the Labor Party at a federal level were really running hard on.
So living up in West End's such a, and it always has been, I guess, a really vibrant place and community. I mean, you mentioned there the 70s and the 80s, during the time of the Springbok protests as well as the Commonwealth Games protests, there's always been a really strong, Aboriginal presence here in South Brisbane, West End, as well as migrant community presence. So in the comparison of being, on the one hand, the Biocchi Peterson era, but also this like really vibrant community of people from all different backgrounds.
Mm. Yeah, it is an amazing community, and I'm really proud of the fact that a lot of the big thinkers and the rights-based activists really consider this area as an area where they can voice their big ideas, where they can protest against injustice. And we've seen that time and time again, whether it's under the Bjelke Petersen era or whether it's under successive governments. I remember, Carver, my first week in Parliament was the week that Tent Embassy was essentially forcibly removed from Musgrave Park. And cops were sent in, and I remarked upon that in my first speech in Parliament, because I think that we need a space for protest and for alternative ideas without the thought of the cops being sent in to silence that.
I mean, this is also fairly, it's a feature of the sort of the formation of the Labor Party, in the union movement about speaking up for rights and issues affecting people. But more to the fact, the end of the Bjelke Peterson era was a huge surge in where Labor really came to the fore. And there was a lot of sort of old, really staunch Labor members that were actually part of a lot of those protests. I mean, I remember stories of people like Peter Beattie and Wayne Goss and others actually being involved in those protests, and even volunteering services to health services and legal services and that sort of stuff.
Absolutely. I'm incredibly proud of the tradition that the Labor Party has in the fight for recognition for justice of Australia's First Nations people. And I hope that I can bring that same passion and perspective to my role as Minister for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Partnerships. I think that there's certainly a long way to go, but I'm enormously proud. Like I think of, Whitlam dropping the sand through the hands of Vincent Ngari, and I think about Paul Keating in Redfern, the first time a leader of this nation had taken responsibility for the injustices performed or pushed against Aboriginal Australians by white Australians. And then, of course, the national apology by Kevin Rudd 10 years ago this year. And I know that it will be a Labor Prime Minister of this country, and I hope that it's Bill Shorten, who actually does deliver treaty and the Makarrata and delivers constitutional recognition of Australia's First Nations people.
I want to expand on a lot of that.
Yeah, yeah.
and we'll get to it. But just to sort of finish off with West End. Obviously, the local member here. What does it mean for you to sort of be part of this community now and represent this community? And I guess what is your vision and sort of what do you see for West End over the coming years?
I think if I can sum it up in one sentence, it would be about making sure that the diversity, that the vibrancy, that spirit of difference is maintained with our community through all of the change and growth and development that we are experiencing. Like many places around the world and here in Australia, we are seeing, a population density happen in the inner city. So it's really important that we don't lose sight of the character that West End is and the inner south is, and that is about a community that really sees itself as a community that really engages in the public policy debate, in politics, that has a view about how to change the world. And I really want that to be maintained through all of this change that happens.
And it is, like we were just saying, there's that strong history of that sort of activism and just in engagement by the West End community. So,
yeah,
it is a great place to be, and we're certainly very proud to be part of it and located here in our building. But obviously one of the new portfolios for you this year is the Department of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Partnerships. How is that going for you? It's only been about 3-4 months now. How are you finding it? And I guess what do you see as the major priorities for you moving forward?
Look, I'm not going to lie. It's going to be an enormous challenge. And I think it's going to be an enormous challenge because I come in at a time when there are a lot of big debates happening in the area of Indigenous politics in Australia. Just recently, I came back from Canberra where we did the Closing the Gap Steering Committee, delivered their report on progress towards closing the gap. And it's not a pretty picture. Like, we are failing and we need to be really honest about that. So there's a big conversation around closing the gap. Now, the federal government wants to start a process called Close the Gap Refresh. And I'm really keen to be working in partnership with communities and traditional owners and First Nations people around what that is. Because if the refresh is about sort of lowering the bar or dumbing it down because we're failing as governments, then let's be honest about that. And I've got a particular view, and I think the Queensland government will have a particular view about whether or not we participate in something like that. Fundamentally, Aboriginal people, Torres Strait Islander people, they deserve the same opportunities, they deserve the same equality, they should have the same life expectancy as any other Australian. And if we can't redouble our efforts, if we can't be honest about how we're failing, then quite frankly, we should vacate and let other people do the job that we're not up to.
Senator Dodson, along with Linda Burney and Senator McCarthy, which is essentially the Labor contingent, all Indigenous people came out and spoke fairly strongly about their thoughts of the report. You spoke there about the refresh, and essentially the language, or I guess the sort of information that's coming out of Canberra now, is another round of consultations. And I thought Senator Dodson said something very poignant, which captures the sentiment of a lot of people, which is how many more consultations do we need? You know, we have Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community controlled organisations that have worked over the last 30 years around these issues and around these, you know, all of the things that are trying to be redressed by the government but never seem to be listened to. I guess what I'm trying to say or ask is, what is the sort of level of consultation, or what is the sort of, you know, your intention for the relationship between our communities and the government in terms of actually, you know, having our priorities and our views listened to about how we deal with these issues?
I think that's a really important and critical question, Carver. I think that going forward, relationship is the key. And I participated in the Policy Leadership Forum yesterday that DATSET pulls together of academics, service providers, key leaders within the Indigenous community here in Queensland, and listened firsthand to their perspectives around things like the refresh and the piece of work that we've done here in Queensland via the Productivity Commission around investment in Indigenous program services in discrete communities and the outcomes that we've seen. So fundamentally, what I'm being told is we have to actually get the relationship right. And that relationship has got to be about partnering to deliver more control, self-determination and autonomy for Indigenous services and discrete communities around what works best for them. And you're absolutely right. There are some amazing Indigenous organisations, and I'm really proud of the number that exist and call West End and South Brisbane home. Amazing organisations doing incredible stuff, successful stuff that should actually be celebrated and promoted, like Murray Radio, you know. So it is about how do we get that autonomy and the self-determination right. It's not actually about another report telling us what continues to be wrong. It's actually about saying, well, this is working here. How about we trial it here and see if it's working? Because quite frankly, if we're afraid of failing on that front, then we're not paying attention to the fact that we've been failing for many decades.
It's, you know, in this day and age of reconciliation plans and all of these different ways and means that people actually engage with communities, it's one thing, you know, consultation and that actually empowerment to me seems like it's two very different things. You know, on the one hand, it's saying that we want to hear your story and what you think. And on the other hand, I think there's a level of how do we give you the resources to do what you do well. Is that sort of, you know, something that we could expect?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like the resources that we currently invest, that we say we invest and tell people how to spend it and what they should spend it on, is not producing the results that we need. And I was very proud of the program, a program that I introduced when I was Infrastructure Minister in the last term. It's called Works for Queensland, and I have to say that some of the biggest supporters of this program are those Indigenous councils in, you know, discrete communities up in far north Queensland. And it was about actually getting local infrastructure built but getting people into work, particularly in regional Queensland where we know that unemployment levels are quite high. Now, some of the best performing local councils in terms of delivering this project on time, on budget, and making sure that all of these people, a lot of people were employed and upskilled, were in Indigenous communities. And I'm really proud of what they've done. So it's clear, like, communities have capacities. Indigenous controlled organisations have capacity, you know, like, it's actually about us being brave and courageous and smart enough to say what we're doing and how we're doing it isn't producing the results we need. It's quite clear that when we do it in this way, respectful relationships, you know, respectful capacity, and if we say we're going to give you this money, you do what you like, you're going to be accountable for it, do what you like, but these are the outcomes we want, you know, communities rise to the occasion.
One of the great things, I guess, or one of the great obstacles is always that thing around actually defining what the priorities are. You know, on the one hand, we'll have a government that say, for example, to close the gap, we're going to redress X, Y, Z issues. But for every community, it is about, you know, well, X, Y, Z are sort of an issue, but A, B, C are what we really need to focus on. What I'm asking and what I'm trying to get to is does that dichotomy work on a federal and state level? I mean, can we expect some support from the state government in sort of advocating more of a stronger ear to our communities, to the federal government in what those priorities and stuff are?
Absolutely. I think that one of the things that I've learned in all my time in public policy is sometimes what you actually need to focus on is what communities have identified support, you know, a roundabout process of actually achieving something. I'm not explaining that right, but, you know, sometimes governments or agencies go straight for the problem, when in fact you can actually fix the problem and fix the problem in a much better and enduring way if you listen to local communities about the associated issues that will solve that problem. I think we saw that with what Chris Sara did out at Cherbourg, for example. You know, it wasn't just about getting teachers in the classroom. You didn't solve the education issue by having teachers in the classroom and having, you know, having bricks and mortar. It was actually about relationships with the community. And if you got the relationships right, if you actually had in there something that the kids could see that education could support, then they were much more likely to come to school. And that was a absolute revolution in terms of education in an Indigenous community. So, yeah, it's actually about listening to people on the ground and understanding that sometimes the way we want to get to things, it might be the most direct route, but it's not the best route.
Hmm. And it's a really good example, actually. You know, like in a community, there's the school might be seen as just this separate standalone sort of entity that, you know, the children go off to, but there's no sort of engagement or, you know, I guess buy-in from the community. And there's just all the difference when you have grandmothers, aunties, uncles, you know, and community members working in the school, because it's actually part of the community then.
Yeah. And look, it's actually no different from any other school. You know, I go to lots of PNC meetings. You know, my kids go to schools. The parents are involved and engaged. It is actually about, in a different setting, being culturally aware and understanding that those relationships are just as important.
But that relationship for state-sanctioned services hasn't always been there for Aboriginal communities, you know, and I guess there is a real history of disconnect. You know, and I guess that's essentially where we need to get to, is where there is buy-in from the community in supporting these services. And it sort of stems onto my next point I wanted to discuss. When we're looking at where we need to go with Close the Gap, we're constantly hearing, you know, health referred to now as a sort of social issue as well as just a sort of medical issue. You know, they're talking about the social determinants of health, which is, you know, all encompassing. It's the correlation between poor educational outcomes and employment outcomes that affect, you know, life expectancy in the long run. And how do we start to view health as a holistic issue? What's your thoughts on that? Are we heading in the right direction in terms of, is this the right approach to close the gap?
I think the health agenda is critical. The health and education agenda is critical in terms of closing the gap, because we do know with better education, there's better health outcomes, there's better life expectancy, there's better life options for people. So those two key issues are critical. But the fundamental underlying issue, Kava, I think that you identified it, is poverty, the level of poverty and disadvantage that many, not only discrete Indigenous communities experience, but also, you know, particular cohorts within a larger Indigenous population, like here in Southeast Queensland. You know, the Southeast Queensland Indigenous population, I understand, is going to soon be the largest Indigenous population in one region anywhere in Australia. And I think that's an amazing thing. It should be an amazing thing that we celebrate. But it is actually about making sure that we get services to people in it, right throughout the region. And I think through Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander controlled health services. That is the critical path, and that's what we need to do.
As you know, places like Aches here in Brisbane, their services are going so far beyond now just a medical centre. You know, they have all sorts of social services and dealing with, you know, people with all sorts of social needs and issues that they're redressing and programs to work with it. So, you know, in this day and age, our community organisations are now sort of taking on so much more than they're usually used to. And in that work, we're still got some, you know, some markers that we're still sort of working through. And I want to talk about a few of the big ones before we finish up. And one that we only just spoke about yesterday was stolen wages. Obviously, mm-hmm. This is an ongoing process. There was a reparation scheme that was planned and put on the table, but there's still talk of, and there's still process, early sort of proceedings around a class action. What's your thoughts on how this saga's played out? Obviously, there was two rounds of payments offered to people, as well as an education package. And, you know, for a lot of people, they're not satisfied with that, and they're now looking at an actual class action. What's your thoughts on, firstly, how it was dealt with, and number two, you know, where it's heading?
Well, thanks for that cover. And look, you did say that, you know, there's a legal process that has actually commenced. So I'm really mindful that I don't want to say anything that jeopardises or prejudices that process. But look, I will say that, you know, in hindsight, in 2020 hindsight, I think that, you know, things could have been done better. I absolutely accept that. And that's why when we came back into power in 2015, there was that second round that was offered, and that was about those who felt that there wasn't sufficient time during the first round, or they needed more information, that they could have another opportunity. Now I think that the past operations of government in relation to withholding wages from Indigenous employees was abhorrent, just as I think that the Aboriginal Protection Act and the stealing of children was abhorrent. And I think for any modern government, you know, it's about grappling with how you do the reparation, how you actually, you know, fix it post-event. And that's always, you know, got a lot of complexity in it. But look, in terms of the potential class action litigants, they are entitled to have their day in court. Absolutely, they're entitled to have their day in court. And so I'm very mindful that, you know, I don't say things that would jeopardise their case and the case, yeah.
You know, one of the things that we've really spoken about then was the education package. And they were actually talking about the wages that were quarantined and not paid to people. And then the government at that time actually said, well, we're not going to give you all the money. We're going to put it away for education. I mean, that in itself speaks to that same attitude at that time of taking money and saying, you know, we know what's best. Mm. And I guess, you know, it's positive that it is going into education, but I mean, it speaks to that issue again that we spoke of earlier. There's not this willingness to actually listen and actually, you know, take a step back. It's about this approach of we know what's best. Mm. Yeah, I mean, how do we move on? I guess heal that sort of sentiment between our communities and the state government. That's what I'm really, asking. Yeah,
and that's fair enough. And look, my understanding, and I'm happy to stand corrected, but the education package was set up after the first round, and we put more money on the table for the second round, but the education package still endured. And I guess what I'm saying, Carver, is that what we did in terms of the second round was our indication that we wanted to make sure that those people who didn't feel like they had access through the first round had an opportunity in a second round to get their withheld wages back. So that was about us trying to deliver another reparation package, given that people felt that the first one was a shortfall for them. But my understanding was that the education package was associated with the first one.
Hmm. We'll move on, because I know you don't have much time, and there's, again, it's every year we have a series of these instances where Indigenous people are dying in the custody of police services. It's not just in Queensland; it's an endemic problem right throughout, you know, all states. And you know, it's actually a feature of disadvantaged and marginalised groups the world over, you know, where we see people who are living, as you said, you know, in poverty and low socioeconomic areas, who are consistently incarcerated at a higher rate. We see deaths in custody. We've seen one only last week in Townsville, and I guess, you know, for that community, particularly of Townsville and not far being Palm Island, a lot of families are connected there. There is this sort of, I guess, deja vu sentiment. Now, again, this is something that's currently before the courts and under a coronial investigation, and all the processes are in place. But it does speak to that continuing, you know, poor relationship, particularly with police services in our communities. Does that SIP have sort of, you know, any sort of, I guess, interest in this relationship or thoughts about how we start to see a change in this relationship?
Yeah. Look, DATSIP, clearly people within DATSIP would have views, but, you know, I think it's important that, you know, they're not held responsible for the path that the government or another agency takes. I mean, that, and I do have to put on record, cover that during that incident that you talked about in Townsville, where there was a death in custody, I want to put on record my deep appreciation and thanks to the officers in DATSIP who worked that weekend to not only make sure that I was kept abreast of what was happening, but that there were supports put in place for family and community in relation to the deceased. So they did absolutely excellent work in relation to that. But you are absolutely right. I mean, part of the problem with deaths in custody, and this one was tragic, you know, I do understand that the deceased individual had a history of very chronic ill health, and particularly for a young man, it was incredibly tragic, and that is, you know, that is a feature of poverty and disadvantage, and unfortunately, you know, it is an issue that we still have to grapple with. But as you quite rightly pointed out, there will be an ethical standards review around this. It will be subject to a coronial inquest. If anything untoward happened, it will be absolutely publicly ventilated. But the fundamental issue is how do we make sure that Indigenous people, particularly those with a history of chronic illness, are diverted away from the prison system and from the justice system? That is the critical issue, and that's why it's important that work that's undertaken by the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health community here in South Brisbane is critical, because as you said before, they're not just doing health stuff, they're doing mental health, they're doing youth self-esteem, they're doing childcare, women and children escaping domestic violence. So their footprint is quite large, not only geographically, but also in terms of the critical and important services that they're providing people.
I mean, there's another side to that equation though as well, and that is the QPS, you know, and that is police services. There is a history, you know, there's a pattern of sort of, not only deaths in custody, but I don't want to call it negligence because it's not negligence every time, but there's certainly a lack of awareness where we see this thing play out time and time again. And, you know, in some ways we're actually now starting to see communities kick back in the form of racial discrimination cases and that sort of stuff and actually hold people to account. Is that the way that it should be? Like, I mean, only our communities doing this diversionary work and prevention work and then trying to prosecute their claims in the court, or does some ownership need to sort of occur on the other side of the QPS and others?
Well, I certainly think that that government and all the government agencies have got to play a role in this respect. Absolutely, it's not about communities being the ones that have to fix things after they've been broken, you know, or broken by government. Like, that's not you know, that's certainly not how I envisage this happening. Like, but as I said, if there are things that come out in terms of the coronial inquest, in terms of the ethical review of what happened that night, we will absolutely pay attention to it and we will fix the things that have been identified. But I think you would have seen that the Queensland government took a position in relation to the federal court's view on what happened on Palm Island almost 13 years ago now, and you know that judgment will be upheld and we will not appeal it, and there are a lot of lessons that we need to learn from that.
As I said, you know, a lot of people did have a sense of deja vu, and yes, there are processes in place, the coronial investigations and the like, but you know, it's not all that long ago that all those processes did fail us. And so while we understand that these checks and balances are in place, I guess there's still a lot of uncertainty and a lot of doubt as to whether or not they do and will deliver justice in the long term. And, you know, we are seeing people, with class actions now, stolen wages example, the racial discrimination case of Palm Island, another example. As I understand it, there are lawyers up there again with this death in custody. So I paint this picture to sort of as a bit of a, I guess, representation of where the relationship is. And it does still seem like there's a ways to go in sort of coming together. So in saying that, you have your work cut out for you as not only Indigenous Affairs Minister, Datsit, but also Treasury. But thank you for joining us, and we wish you all the best in working towards bridging that and fixing that relationship.
Thanks, Cover.
No worries. Thank you.